This week on Potlatch, Tim Wallace of Doyon Corporation, Willie Hensley of NANA, and Teresa Peterson of Council comment on the D2 land proposals. Ohio Democratic Representative John Seiberling's subcommittee has been traveling through Alaska to get testimony from Alaskans on a bill by Arizona Democratic Representative Morris Udall. The Udall proposed bill would set aside Alaska lands into various categories. This program is the first of a series of programs on the testimony by Native leaders on this proposal. First, Tim Wallace, president of the Doyon Corporation.
We've been concerned about the reservation of easements on the Native lands, and Doyon has spent more than its share of time in an effort to understand the Secretary's views and policies on easements and seek to ensure its compliance with the provision of the Settlement Act. Throughout the easement process, we've always been amazed on the location of the easements, and they always appear to start and end on Native land. We were told this occurred because of the fact that other lands were public lands, and thus there was no need for easements on it. However, in reviewing the proposed D2 legislations and the policies of the administering agencies, we discovered that this isn't quite true. While the lands may be considered public, the rights and manners in which the public may use them vary greatly from proposal to proposal. And because of the crazy quilt land ownership pattern which is developing in Alaska, the many private lands may be landlocked by the D2 withdrawals. In the Doyon region, the most striking example of this is in the villages in the Yukon Flats. The four villages will be surrounded by the proposed Yukon Flats Wildlife Refuge without any overland access route to them. The basic enabling legislation for wildlife refuges prohibits the granting of any easements to federal or local governments or to private parties without compensation being paid to the federal government at fair market value. Thus, while reserving access easements free of charge across the Native lands, no access would be provided to either the residents of the community or the corporation whose lands are locked up. Doyon faces a similar problem in the 40-mile area, which is adjacent to the Canadian border and south of the Yukon River and north of the Alcan Highway. This is a mineral potential area, and as a result, Doyon will receive title to a number of interesting mineral prospects, which hopefully can be developed to provide an economic base for the corporation. But because of the spider web created by the proposed 40-mile scenic river, many of the prospects will be isolated from established transportation routes. And without guaranteed access across these withdrawals, the chance of their economic development become marginal. And if adequate safeguards are not written into D2 legislation, what Congress intended to occur as a result of the Settlement Act may be defeated by implementation of an overly restrictive D2 legislation. The second area which we're very deeply concerned is the off-site impacts. These are the impacts on adjacent lands which would be created by establishments of various parks and wildlife refuges and other proposals. In many instances, the status would determine the use of the adjacent land. Example of this can be found that created by the Clean Air Act amendments of 1977. These amendments required a Class 1 or pristine status for all existing national parks and for all wilderness areas. Thus, any development of the resources on the lands adjacent to the parks and wilderness areas, which we may need to undertake, would be severely limited if not precluded. While the amendments provide for a Class 2 intermediate standard for the D2 withdrawals, it's obvious that there will be great pressures to upgrade to the Class 1 to conform with the standards set by the rest of the Act. Given the land ownership patterns in Alaska, this is very likely that without assistance from Congress, a large amount of native and state lands will be precluded from any type of development because of the required air status over adjacent D2 lands. It's surely not the intent of Congress to preclude ecologically sound development on private lands because of an artificially high standard, air standard over adjacent lands. In many instances, a native corporation may be faced with a choice upon which its survival would depend, a choice between, say, cutting timber over tens of thousands of acres or opening a mine which would utilize perhaps only one section. To my way of thinking, if it takes 130 years for a tree to be replaced in our region, the mine is a far better alternative. Yet that alternative, which might be available if adjacent lands were Class 2, would not be available if a Class 1 status were imposed. We're also deeply concerned that similar standards and the resulting problems may be imposed in the future under the water quality laws. A third offsite is that which results from the wilderness classification that may be given many of these areas. By classifying an area as a wilderness, motorized vehicles, airplanes, etc., are forbidden, except where their use is established, and only then under regulations as the secretary deems appropriate. I doubt if there were many areas of the state which have not experienced and are not experiencing, to some extent, the use of motorized vehicles or airplanes. Yet their continued use for transportation would be committed to the discretion of the secretary. A villager living in a community completely surrounded by a park or refuge would be forbidden to use his boat or snow go off private or state lands. Provision must be made in legislation to avoid this from happening. Unfortunately, we don't have any faith in the bureaucracy to correctly carry out legislation without specific directive. We spent too much time and money seeking to get the secretary to follow the intent of Congress as to the Settlement Act in situations where there exists absolutely no discretion at all. A more subtle impact of the wilderness areas is that created by the lack of provisions of the use of motorized vehicles for access to any of these areas. There should be a recognition by Congress that the administering agency will look solely to its lands for the location of staging areas and headquarters sites and will not unilaterally seek to utilize native lands for these purposes under the guise of easements on those lands. If, for an instance, an aircraft is precluded from a wilderness area which is adjacent to native lands, there would be a great temptation to reserve site easements on our lands where aircraft and motorized vehicles are allowed as staging areas for the people going onto the federal lands. I assure Mr. Chairman that this is not an idle concern on our part. The proposed easement plans for lands adjacent to D2 wilderness areas provide for campsites, roads, and float plane landing facilities, all within several miles of the wilderness area. We have no objection to easements to allow people to cross our lands to federal lands, but we do strongly object to use of our lands for purposes that should be provided by the administering agencies on federal lands themselves. A third major area of our concern is the need for adequate protection for subsistence use. In 1971, the Conference Committee which wrote the Settlement Act stated that, quote, "The Conference Committee, after careful consideration, believes that all native interests, subsistence, resource lands can and will be protected by the Secretary. The Conference Committee expects both the Secretary and the State to take any action necessary to protect the subsistence needs of the natives," unquote. Thus, it was recognized early that the continued protection of subsistence on federal lands must continue. Subsistence is critical to the survival as a people. The land which is subject to your deliberation is our home. We fish its waters, we take game from its forests, and it sustains us. We have not come to exploit it. Yet the laws upon which this committee will base its actions are written for a people who have a different relationship with the land. The preamble to the Wilderness Act states that it is in the intention to preserve land in such a manner to provide that the earth and its community are untrampled by man, where man himself is a visitor and does not remain. For my people, this is a foreign concept. How can one be a visitor in his own home? We are much part of that land as the moose, the ptarmigan, or the lynx. To briefly put it, Mr. Chairman, is in the areas is that we would like to have the opportunity, as afforded under the Land Claims Settlement Act, to be able to develop such lands as we have in order to get us an economic stability, in order to pay the taxes when the land becomes eligible for taxation. We would like to be able to prevent a takeover bid from larger companies when the stock becomes eligible for sale. And if we do not reach that point in time, then the complete intent of the Land Claims Act for the native population of Alaska will be thwarted. And the larger corporations, the multinational corporations, will then own the corporations to use its land totally for development.
I'm not ashamed to say that I've loved you well. I'm not ashamed to let you know. I'm just a name, that's all. Scratched upon your wall, you used it well, but what the hell? What walls are for. I'm not ashamed to listen to the fast falling rain. In the morning upon my window, I'm not afraid to cry. I'm not ashamed to try to be your friend once again. 'Cause that's what friends are for. Friends are for sorting out the hang-ups that we hide. Walls are for shutting out the love we feel inside. I'm not ashamed, no, to talk it over once again, to rearrange my vocabulary. But I can't seem to find any words to change your mind, because I left them all behind. And that's what words are for. Words are for explaining the mistakes we might have made. Names are for calling when there's nothing left to say. On your wall, you used it well, but what the hell? That's what walls are for.
That was Gordon Lightfoot. Next, Willie Hensley of NANA recalls his testimony before the Cyberling Committee on August 20th, 1977. In Fairbanks.
Basically, the NANA position is in support of the federal state land use planning recommendations to the Secretary of Interior. And while our region is particularly interested in the ability of the people to continue to subsist off the land, the state has virtually no or minimal land selections in our area. Consequently, the private lands that would be there are primarily our own lands, and lands that would be designated in one category or another under this legislation. And at this point in time, our primary interest is in conserving the people's ability to hunt and fish into the indefinite future, because this is their primary mode of livelihood and will be for some time to come.
Who should ensure this subsistence hunting management, the state or the federal government?
The recommendation of the Nana Regional Corporation is that the federal government manage the fish and game in that region. Now, this doesn't mean to say that it should be managed by the federal government throughout the state. This is our feeling about our region, and don't have much to say about how it should be handled in other regions. But inasmuch as that land is primarily our own land and primarily federal, we feel that the state has a constitutional inability to really provide for the protection of the people's right to hunt and fish. Consequently, we are recommending that the federal government retain control over fish and game.
You made a recommendation to Chairman Seiberling about a particular area around a particular river. Would you recap that?
Yes. We, of course, are not interested in closing our options in that area in terms of development either, because times change and the people in that area know that. Consequently, we were recommending a slight change in federal withdrawals to allow us to select an area called the Red Dog area, which has potential lead and zinc ore possibilities, and that is up near the Nortac area, and apparently the chairman thinks it's there's some possibility of changing the lines there.
Music from Barrow, thanks to the dancers and to Folkways Records. Next, we hear Teresa Peterson of Council. She attended Cornell University in New York State this past year and had an opportunity to testify on the Udall proposal while in the lower 48. Here, she reads her text.
I'm known as Oxedoc in the Nupiat language, or Teresa Peterson in English. I was born and raised on the Seward Peninsula, and am presently a student at Cornell University. I speak on behalf of my culture, which has been in existence for the order of tens of thousands of years. Or put in another way, we have had several dozen bicentennials. Although we have no automobile license plates to advertise our longevity, we still have most of our unspoiled lands and waters. We are hopeful that legislation may serve to preserve these. Native people whose land and cultures are eroded by an alien society suffer more than the loss of their homeland. The loss more closely approximates an eradication of success and replacement with failure. The 1971 Settlement Act has thrust upon Alaska Native cultures monetary overtones in the form of required incorporation, known generally as the regional corporations. These arrangements are precarious and are now meeting with uncertain success and wavering acceptance. I would estimate that these failures may exist because the incorporation concept is incompatible with Native cultures, in which case significant amendments to the Settlement Act will rapidly become mandatory. When the wild leaves the wilderness, in a mere 200 years, Western technology in the United States has degraded the landscape through mindless overuse and exploitation. This has paralleled accelerated use of fuels and minerals to the point of panic, desperation, crisis, and even conflict. In a period of foreseeable scarcity of fuels, Western man has consistently allowed himself to be tricked into this unnecessary condition through his waste and unsystematic behavior towards nature. While some cultures wait till the last moment to modify consumption of resources, we Eskimos and Indians have routinely conserved as a matter of lifestyle. We have never known of a resource crisis or fuel panic, nor needed or depended upon bureaucratic conservation training such as energy plans or speed limits. Likewise, we have never invented nor needed to conceive of the idea of parks and preserves. It is this conceptual problem that is the source of misunderstanding which makes our approach to nature so essentially different. Now that Americans have recognized a measure of importance to wilderness, they are panic-stricken about this and have delivered this panic to our doorsteps. Now we are forced to help them quell that panic and bring relief. It is certainly within our altruistic nature to help, but I wonder if their relief requires our death. If, for example, an American interprets wilderness as that which can be experienced from the confines of a motorhome and superhighway system, that interpretation makes no sense in terms of wilderness. H.R. 39, as related to Public Law 92-203. A most important function of your thoughtful legislation, Mr. Chairman, is to preserve land. This issue is a derivation of the 1971 Settlement Act. You must remind yourselves that natives were denied the opportunity of choice for prime land in Alaska. As I view it, H.R. 39 legislation serves also to hold the Claims Act up for more exposure, closer scrutiny, and exertive testing. Please keep that in mind. The two are so closely tied they may, in final analysis, prove more identical than anyone expects. Subsistence. Who eats what? I ask that this bill, H.R. 39, serve as motivation for a more widespread understanding of the absolute tie that natives have with these lands. Some groups maintain that subsistence lifestyle is a difficult affair to determine. Actually, this is not insuperably difficult to describe. I suggest that we take the burden of proof off of the native and simply recognize that natives do not significantly maintain nor contribute to agriculture. Agribusiness, like urbanization, is emphatically not a part of the circumpolar cultures. I will bet you a 65-pound salmon that you will not find one native who is willing to give up subsistence forever. The importance of subsistence lifestyle can be illustrated by the following examples. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Nunavak National Wildlife Refuge and the Yukon Flats Wildlife Refuge, the respective proposed wildlife refuges, produce the protein equivalent in meat, hides, and fish to an estimated $30 million annually. Kachemak Bay in the Kenai Peninsula, the area of proposed Kenai Fjords National Monument, has been demonstrated to be one of the highest producers of marine protein on the planet. This area now serves a crucial subsistence role, both as a commercial fishery and a native subsistence fishery. You may recall that this bay and fisheries were saved from petroleum impact through the cooperation of commercial and native fisheries interests. We have traditionally maintained a lifestyle in which we lived off the land and expect to continue without spatial or temporal constraints imposed upon us by the boundaries of national parks, wildlife refuges, and wild and scenic rivers. Native input, problems with representation. In the last 4 years, I have seen with pipeline impact a distribution of vulgarity and insensitive behavior towards the landscape and to the people. This has hurt so deeply that I must begin to seek an explanation and understanding of its cause. A recent issue appended of the Alaska Advocate, May 12, 1977, shows that Anchorage's predominantly white population exhibits a marked tendency towards racial prejudice against Alaska Natives. In such a climate, a Native cannot expect to be treated as a full citizen, especially with regard to the judicial system. Of all the human indignity to be borne by Natives, this I regard as most unnecessary. Since this study also showed Natives characterized as easygoing and harmless, I must remark again that since Native peoples are quiet, conservative, and considerate by nature, to acquire from testimony from us requires much more work on your part than on ours. Additionally, since these attitudes represent a statistically significant portion of Alaska's newly arrived residents, it is their representation you hear through our state senators, congressional delegate, and governor. The statistics of representation you see may be highly weighted against our interests through such proven racist attitudes. We have every right to be concerned about this as citizens, every need to guard ourselves against racist influences, and every opportunity to expose it when it occurs. Please examine the appended article with care. You must consult the Natives on this legislation and on anything that will affect us. You need more input from Alaska's Natives. In summary, Alaska Natives are not only citizens of the United States, but through our genetic, cultural, and land-based similarities with citizens of other sovereign countries, we have a type of built-in ambassadorship. This I regard as a thorough privilege. Your efforts to protect lands in Alaska through H.R. 39 performs an appreciable service to this, our unique relationship with our neighbors. The reconciliation of Western man with the natural world is no longer merely desirable, it is a necessity. While H.R. 39 and 5605 deal with the delicate balance of exotic animals and natural resources, they deal with Alaska's original inhabitants. I would like to mention that Congress was naive in investing the veto power in the Secretary of Interior concerning subsistence people. I repeat that the Circumpolar Natives have lived systematically, successfully, gently, and orderly with this land for tens of thousands of years. By any standards, this is a high level of success. We all know what one does not do with success. We don't argue with it.
Teresa, how does the Udall bill relate to the Land Claims Act, and how will it be a benefit to Alaska Native people as you see it?
Well, first of all, the Udall bill is a derivation of the 1971 Settlement Act. It was written in for national interest lands for 114 million acres to be decided upon by 1978. As far as it being a benefit for the natives, I can see that if boundaries are going to be set, I would like to see them, if they are mandatory, to see them that they will guarantee subsistence for the natives, and they cannot stop that for our survival.
How about development on these lands by Native corporations? Will the Udall bill perhaps interfere with those corporations that want to develop, say, mining or or other industries, building hotels, building parking lots, whatever?
Well, I'm not sure. It depends on the individual corporation, what they decide to do, and they will have to work this out with Congress and with the federal government. And whatever they decide, I think they should decide it with long-term and long, you know, goals, interests.
Teresa Peterson of Council. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening.
Potlatch came to you from KUAC in Fairbanks. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gave some of the money to produce this program.